be seated. The second case for oral argument to this morning is Karen Dunham versus Lake County Commission et al. Jimmy Nasser is here on behalf of the appellant, Karen Dunham, and Zachary Peterson is present arguing on behalf of Lake County. Each side will have 15 minutes to present your initial argument, and then Mr. Nasser, you'll have an additional five-minute rebuttal after that. You may proceed at this time, Mr. Nasser.
May it please the court and the counsel. My name is Jimmy Nasser. I am the attorney for Karen Dunham in this case, and this is the second appeal on this. We didn't have an oral argument on the first, but on this one we do. The case summary, just a quick synopsis, would be that there is a variance in a conditional use that was a part of the first appeal. This court affirmed the conditional use and remanded the variance back to the board. And before I get into the remand, what happened on remand, I think it's important to note the posture of the case when it was remanded. As this court stated in the Lake Hendricks case, in these 11-2 SDCL 11-2 cases, you need to have standing as part of the jurisdictional requirement to be here. And in the first case, we have a circuit court ruling on the merits, which would presume jurisdiction to issue that ruling. Karen then appealed to this court, and this court affirmed the conditional use, which is a ruling on the merits, which again would presume jurisdiction, and it remanded the variance. It is the variance that is the subject of the standing challenge brought by the board on remand. It is the same exact facts that was part of the first case that is now being challenged in the second case. And they're saying now that there is no jurisdiction. So we think that that would be a clear error on the circuit court when it decided. This court remanded to the circuit court, of course, with the jurisdiction saying, you know, let's make some findings on a remand regarding the variance. The circuit court has essentially said we don't have jurisdiction to hear what you remanded. And that's the effect of the ruling that the circuit court has entered.
Let me ask you this. Let me jump ahead a little bit. Let's assume we were to find standing existed in this case. Do you think we can review the merits on appeal? Do we need to remand it back to let the circuit court?
I do think that the merits can be reviewed. This is a cold record. Everything is in the record that I think is necessary to resolve the merits of the appeal. And I found a quote, and I can't remember the case off my head, where it says the Supreme Court can read the record as good as any other court. So I do think it's eligible for that.
Well, procedurally, this was presented as a motion to dismiss in front of the trial court. So we're coming from a motion to dismiss. Am I right about that?
Correct.
So there was no request, for instance, if there was going to be somebody was going to ask for additional evidence or something like that. None of that was addressed the second time around.
We, at the hearing at the circuit court, I asked for an opportunity to supplement the record in light of the standing challenge. I don't think I need to supplement the record in light of the merits of the case, if that answers your question.
Working along those lines, then, how does a one-foot variance on the opposite side of the building from your lot and a five-foot variance into the rear yard adjacent to your lot cause an injury?
The injury that Karen has alleged would be in both the daylight, the size of the structure. So even though the variance is on the opposite side on one yard, on the backyard it is connecting to her property. It's not the dividing line between the property, but they share that back line. So the building is extending further than it would be but for that variance. That creates the drainage issue. That we're creating more surface area to collect water and deposit into a smaller location. That is, the board itself, when they originally approved the variance, they stated we require a drainage plan, presumably along similar reasoning there. And while the Hodney Homes never did actually produce a drainage plan and file it with the board, that is part of the injury that we've alleged, and I don't think it can be disputed since it's part of the requirements that the board also found at the original hearing. So going back to, I think, on the issue of the procedure of where this ended up at the circuit court. So it's reading through the case law is not the easiest on this topic. We have Rule 12, SDCL 15.6.12b. This is 12b1, motion to dismiss for lack of subject matter jurisdiction. We don't have a procedure outlined in that statute of converting a 12b1 to a motion for summary judgment. The statute expressly says that is for a 12b5 motion to dismiss, which would be failure to state a claim. And so it's unclear in this case what the circuit court did in terms of standard of review and the procedure it followed. It did not allow us to supplement the record, which I believe is a violation of the Hare case we cited. It needs to give us notice that it's intending to convert it to a summary judgment and dispose of it that way. That we can infer the circuit court did do some type of summary judgment analysis because it was relying on this court's Powers decision. And the Powers decision is a motion to dismiss that got converted to a summary judgment motion. In that case, I believe there was multiple times that the record was supplemented after the motion was brought, and my client was deprived of that opportunity.
Well, if the circuit court, so I'm going to return to the Chief Justice's initial question. If, as you say, the circuit court's review was as restricted as you say it was, and shouldn't have been, but in your view, it was very restricted, very circumscribed. How is it then, if we determine that there is standing, that we could go ahead with a review of the merits on the cert petition and essentially supplant the function of the circuit court, which if I'm hearing you correctly, never even got close to, at least in your view, on the merits. How is it that we could do that?
Because the circuit court is not the fact-finding body. That would be the Board of Adjustment. The Board of Adjustment was what this court remanded the variance to. So this court said, Board, go issue some specific findings under, I think, 505 of the ordinance, and because you didn't do it the first time. And so it's not the circuit court that's making those findings. It's the board that needed to make them. My client appealed the board's decision back to the circuit court, and it's the circuit court that then is the initial appellate court on this matter. Does that answer the question?
Yeah, so you wouldn't propose to have any evidence on whether they regularly pursued their authority or acted unlawfully or anything like that?
I'm sorry?
You wouldn't have any evidence or you wouldn't suggest anything that they didn't regularly pursue their authority or anything like that? See, I understood you earlier to say that you didn't have an opportunity to supplement the record. I'm trying to figure out what you want to supplement, if it just relates to standing, if there's something else in there.
I do believe if I were to supplement the record with the circuit court, it would have been limited to the issue of standing. If the court was going, I think it's in the court's discretion to then have an evidentiary hearing if it is inclined to do that, but so far the court has not, the circuit court did not indicate it was inclined to do that, and it didn't do it the first time. So it's kind of unique in South Dakota because we don't have intermediate appellate courts, but that is kind of how the circuit court acts in this case, but it also has this element where it can invoke the evidentiary parts of SDCL 11-264. I believe it is, if it wants to take further testimony. So in that regard, if the record didn't have the evidence, I think that the court needs to make that analysis. That's a different issue in terms of needing to remand it to further expand on the record. I do think that would be a reasonable approach. So going back to the 12B rule that does not, the procedure that should be utilized, it's not clear, do we convert a 12B1 to a motion for summary judgment as was done in Powers? Did the Powers case, is that kind of limited to its facts because the parties maybe consented to that summary judgment process as part of it? Or is that the required review if a court considers things outside the scope of the pleadings? And in this case, the circuit court did state in its opinion that it is reviewing the affidavit of Karen Dunham, which was the attachment to her petition. That was how she verified her complaint. And so I don't believe the circuit court actually reviewed anything outside the petition itself, which would have been akin to a facial attack on the pleadings under 12b1. And so that leads me back to the 12b process is, do we have a facial attack, do we have a factual attack on the pleadings? The court didn't distinguish between the two, and I'm not sure it's available when the challenge is based upon standing. And that's the Wraith v. Selden United States Supreme Court case that this court cited in the Sierra Club case for a different reason. But in that case, they're saying if it's standing, you need to presume that the statements are correct. Let me get that language correct here.
When you say you're not sure it's available, not sure what's available.
Not sure that a factual attack on the pleadings is available on a 12b1 when standing is what is being challenged. Because there's the United States Supreme Court that stated on a 12b1 challenge that you need to presume that the allegations in the complaint are correct and that it must be construed in the favor of the petitioner.
So you're not saying that you couldn't have evidence, or it's not an evidentiary question as to standing. You're saying, at least as to the procedural posture under 12b1, are limited to the court's limited to looking at the pleadings.
Yeah, and they must presume that it's correct because we're trying to invoke the jurisdiction of the court to bring a controversy before it, essentially. And so, here in this case, we have a neighbor complaining of an illegal use of property directly next door. And so the statutes 11-2 does not really get into, you must complain of X, Y, and Z in order to, it's just that we have this kind of more generic aggrieved person standard that the Cable decision went into the analysis on what it means to be aggrieved. And it's more of a unique injury, if I'm understanding that correctly, than it is a value-based injury. I believe it's Cable, there is the discussion on the Dakota Territory case that's about 100 years old, and that goes into the mathematical formula of whether we're comparing someone who has a valuable loss versus someone who has a small loss, and that's not the relevant inquiry. The inquiry, if you have someone that has $10,000 in damage and someone with $10 in damage, if the problem isn't unique, they haven't satisfied the standing requirements of 11-2. They both suffered monetary loss. And so we're looking at the character of the loss, I think, more so than, the varying values of the loss. Moving into 12B, completing my thought on the 12B1, is so if do we do the Powers decision that is going to convert things to summary judgment? Is that the procedure we're to follow? In this case, we have the United States Supreme Court saying, we have to presume that the allegations are true. And the summary judgment standard has more of, well, you consider in the light of the moving party under summary judgment standard. You don't necessarily presume the facts are true under that. You must meet those facts at summary judgment with evidence. And I think therein lies the difference between a standing to challenge under 12b1 and a standing proving your case, essentially, under motion for summary judgment, or proving you have the facts to try a case under 12b, under 56. Sorry for all the numbers. I see I only have about a minute and a half, and I don't know if that's enough time to get into the merits of, on the remand, what went, how they didn't, the board didn't comply with the board's remand instructions. But essentially, they are confirming on remand that what makes this unique is they're selling boats out of the property. And that, in our view, would be an illegal use of commercial storage zoning. They basically changed the zoning to commercial use by using a variance, and that in the definition of variance under the ordinance is expressly prohibited. You cannot alter approve of the variance because of use in an adjoining district. And so I believe under the merits, there is no set of facts that can be, that the board can use to sustain this, since what they're doing is fundamentally flawed. The lot one conformed to the ordinance before the Hodney purchased it. After their purchase, they removed the building that conformed. They constructed one that did not conform. The sole reason they did that is their own desire to have a commercial enterprise connected to the adjacent business.
So, can I ask a question?
Go ahead.
So your argument is that under 505.3, the board couldn't grant a variance because of the use, because the use is prohibited under the zoning ordinance for the LP3?
Correct. It retails.
But does the CUP matter to that? Because 505.3 says that under no circumstances shall the Board of Adjustment grant a variance to allow a use not permissible. I'm with you up to that point. Under the terms of the ordinance. The ordinance also allow for the opportunity of having non-conforming use and obtaining authority through a conditional use permit. So if the CUP is okay, does that satisfy the terms of the ordinance requirement of 505.3?
Respectfully, no. The conditional use, I don't believe, can be used to change the zoning of lot one itself.
It doesn't say the zoning. It says under the terms of the ordinance.
Well, the terms of the ordinance in that context, I believe, are referring to what a permissible use in LP3 is, which is commercial and residential storage. And so the argument my client is making is that is retail sales is not contained within that. That would require rezoning into a commercial use.
Okay.
Thank you. Mr. Peterson, you may proceed with your argument.
So if the variances had been found to be, if the board had declined to grant the variances, then would that have impacted the conditional use permit?
If the board had declined the variances, then I think they would have had to revisit the validity of the conditional use.
And that was actually noted. So in this court, we noted in a footnote in the Dunham 1 that we took no position on how or if a different determination on the variance might affect the conditional use permit.
Correct. But because the variance was upheld by the board, there was nothing to revisit on the conditional use permit.
Understood. But she's challenging that decision by the board. To grant the variance. So then if that still makes the conditional use permit in play, depending on how that turns out, how does she not continue to have standing based on her original complaints that she, or injuries that she alleged?
I think there's a distinction to be drawn between standing to appear in front of the board and make the challenge and standing to bring an action in court. By the time this thing was appealed and a petition for writ of cert was filed, it was only the variance that remained at issue. In other words, the board granted the variance. It did not deny the variance. So the conditional use permit did not come back into play.
So you're treating this, the second attempt at a petition for writ of certiorari, as a separate petition that has to independently have standing, correct?
That's exactly right. And that's truly the basis of our argument on standing here, whether you're talking about a facial or a factual challenge.
So explain to me your position then. When challenged on the fact that you had not filed a return to the second petition for writ of certiorari, the argument was, we don't need to file one, we already filed one. And if we do need to file something, we can just amend our original return. Explain that apparent contradiction to me.
Your Honor, when we filed the motion to dismiss, I filed it with the intention that it would be a factual attack and that any evidence that would be submitted relevant to standing would be filed by the opponent. It would become an issue that would be dealt with at the hearing. What I learned when I got to the hearing is that there would be no evidence filed. More importantly, and for purposes of our argument, there was no allegation made in the second petition of any harm. So whether you're talking about a facial challenge or a factual challenge, Ms. Dunham does not get there on the second challenge. And so as to not filing the writ, I guess I had assumed that with the 12B motion, you know, that I thought of it in terms of the rules of civil procedure. When you move to dismiss a pleading, the assumption is that if the court denies the motion, then you will then move forward with your answer and everything like that. Well, in this case, the court granted the motion, and we never got to the point where we filed the writ.
Under the reading that Ms. Dunham lacks standing because the variance on that north edge of Lot 1 that joins her property meets the 2-foot setback requirement. So under that theory, then she lost everything in Dunham 1, because that was the case in Dunham 1. The case that we considered the first time around featured a 2-foot compliant setback on her side. So under that theory, that because it's compliant on that north side, she lacks standing, she lost. That seems like not what we decided in Dunham.
Well, here's what I would say to that, Justice Salter. I think where I part ways with that analysis is that she still has to allege and prove some manner of being aggrieved. It's not just that it wasn't a variance as to that north property line. If she wants to claim that the rear yard or the south yard or south side setback variance somehow injures her or harms her, she can still make that allegation. She didn't.
I understand your argument in that regard, but let's go back one step further. Would it have been equally true that the board in the first appeal should have said, don't worry about this variance issue because we're compliant on the north side and she has no adverse impact as a result of that? And so she lacks standing or she lacks any harm as a result of that aspect of the variance. That wasn't the argument. Is that significant? Now that we've considered the case one time, it's gone back, and all of a sudden we have a standing argument, and the argument that she's got to support and justify an injury claim for a set of circumstances that has existed all along.
I'm afraid I'm not following your question. I
would you have needed to make an argument in the first appeal that she has no adverse impact as a result of the compliant setback requirement on the north border?
I would say no for two reasons. The first one being that subject matter jurisdiction is not something the parties or the court can change. I mean,
standing, sorry to interrupt you, is not subject matter jurisdiction. It is necessary to assert subject matter jurisdiction, but it is not subject matter jurisdiction. And unlike subject matter jurisdiction, standing can be waived.
Well, that's not my... I mean, I look at the Lake Hendricks case, and I find it hard to imagine a case where standing could be waived.
Look at Whitesell versus Rapid City, 2014-41. It's a work comp case. But in any event, go ahead.
The other reason, even if you assume that we couldn't raise, or that there isn't a waiver argument, or that waiver isn't the issue, the other part of it is that the case complexion changed once the conditional use permit had been affirmed. And our position was the court approved of the size of this building. And so the issues relating to this is too big, it's overbearing, things like that, had already been decided. And so when we're talking strictly about the setback variance that relates to other lot lines, the issue that I raised through my motion to dismiss is, what is the harm? Because the harm that's been alleged before dealt strictly with the issues that tied in with the conditional use permit. What is the harm related to the setback variances that were granted? And as I said, there was nothing pled, there was nothing presented on those issues.
I would like to hear your response to the Chief Justice's question to your opposing counsel about, if we were to reverse on the standing issue, is there value? Is there a good reason to remand it to the circuit court? Will you do something different in the circuit court than what we already have in the record? Or should we merely conduct a merits review now if we get to that issue?
From the board's perspective, I don't envision any evidence being presented on the issue of whether we regularly pursued our authority. However, I would, you know, given what's been said in some of the previous decisions, if the court were to reverse this on a facial challenge and send it back, I still think that first element under 11-261 is in play for a factual challenge. And I would make that challenge here. I don't think I need to, because like I said, I think that whether you look at the record as a whole and examine whether there's any evidence of harm, or you look strictly at the pleadings, you don't get there either way if you're Mrs. Dunham on this record, because she's neither pled nor presented any evidence of harm as a result of these setback variances.
How would if we determine if there's standing, how is it that you would propose to go back on remand and relitigate factually that issue? Is that what you're saying?
Well, I think that, you know, what's envisioned is a motion for summary judgment or as part of the merits of the case on final briefing, you know, after the presentation of the writ and after, you know, a full development of the factual record. I guess I had intended that to happen with my motion to dismiss, and I think the circuit court thought that was what was supposed to happen too. You know, I represented the circuit court that I thought I was making a factual attack on the standing, because this is a case that had been pending for 2 years.
But you haven't identified that as some sort of an error that the circuit court made by notice of review or some other way.
And I'm not suggesting that. I'm not suggesting it was an error.
So the standing question that we have seems to be the standing question. It seems to me, and I suppose maybe the devil's in the details a little bit in terms of how that might be written, if it were to be written at all that way. But it seems to me very difficult to envision, if we make a determination that standing exists, that it could be relitigated later in the circuit court. So I just was curious about what your thoughts were in that regard.
And like I said, I think if you read some of the more recent, I want to say it was Hubers versus Hanson County, where it was decided on the issue of facial attack on the strength of the pleadings alone. My recollection was the footnote in there described an additional process that could be undertaken when the case was sent back. Now, I don't believe this is a case that should be sent back, because we do have a record here. We have, you know, no avenue for Ms. Dunham under either way exists here. I just don't think that there's been any pleading that suggests that she has standing or any evidence that she has standing.
So what I'm hearing you say is, if the case gets remanded, the evidence you would want to put on relates to standing, not to the merits of the variance?
I think I would be more inclined to make Ms. Dunham put on evidence that relates to standing as opposed to...
Right, but I mean, you're not talking about putting evidence on the merits.
I can't envision it at this point. I mean, I think, you know, the record is clear that the board considered the things that were remanded and made decisions on the issues that it was required to make decisions on. And I think it's also clear from this court's prior decision that the whether those decisions are right or wrong are not fair game for a writ of cert appeal. And I think that's where the appellant's brief eventually goes, is just to take factual shots at the decisions made by the board. I don't think that's fair game, and so that's where I don't necessarily see more evidence being presented on behalf of the board to address the merits of the appeal.
Counsel, could you address what I perceive to be Mr. Nacer's argument, that really what's happening here is that the board is changing the commercial use and the zoning of this property through the use of a variance?
And I don't agree with that. I think what, if you look at the purpose of the Lake Park 3 district, it is set up for oversized commercial storage buildings. And an oversized commercial storage building is exactly what this facility is. It's a place where large boats are stored and displayed.
But it's the sale of these boats and the consumer traffic that entails that's leading to the challenge, right?
And there again, I would argue that the board's consideration of that issue and determination that it did not violate the ordinance, which the board is charged with interpreting, is unassailable, essentially, on appeal. I don't think there's an issue there that calls for any kind of reversal or remand when it's decision-making by the board, interpreting its own ordinance that it administers, and considering the evidence presented to it at the remand hearing. That would be my position on the issue relating to the legality of the use and whether this is actually being used as a commercial property. The board heard that argument, and they made a decision on it. And so I don't think that would be a valid basis for reversal under the writ of cert standard. I see that my time's about to expire. I would simply ask that the court affirm the judgment of dismissal entered by the circuit court. Thank you.
To touch briefly on the remand to the board, this court asked for specific, meaningful findings for the board to make, and the board really didn't do that again on why is this use permissible under the ordinance. They just kind of reiterate the boilerplate, and they state the language exceptional circumstance to be that Lot 1 is adjacent to a commercial property, and that is an exceptional circumstance. I think words need to have meaning, and every boundary of every commercial zoning district in the country has a boundary where something else connects to it. That is not unique. It is not exceptional. And while I realize the board, or this court stated in Dunham 1, we don't get to challenge the factual determinations, I do think there is an overview of does this make any sense? Is this reality that this is actually exceptional? What does that word mean if they're defining it to mean something that is in fact quite common? And I know that's kind of on the gray line of what can the court do in writ of certiorari versus where the board is, but this is my client's chance to review that and to point out that there is nothing exceptional about that. The board, at the remand hearing, the board reapproved the variance before it issued any findings. I stood up at the end of the hearing and said, please issue your findings in public. You're a publicly elected board. And the board declined to issue the findings in public. They went behind into an executive session, came up with their findings, and then announced them later. And I think that is part of the problem. We didn't get the findings even at the remand hearing where it was supposed to happen. They just decided, yes, we approve the variance before they decided this is why we're approving the variance. I think that's problematic. On the issue of waiver of challenge to standing, I am familiar with the Whitesell case. I think I briefed that to the trial court. It is confusing as to, in the context of 11-2, can we waive the challenge to standing and the standing also be jurisdictional? I think just one-liner clarification on that might help future people in my shoes anyway. Because I do think that this court has made a distinction between jurisdiction and standing. They're two separate things. And there is case law, prior precedent, that a challenge to standing can be waived. And in this case, this issue should have been at the onset of this case. My client has spent a lot of money and time litigating this matter, and the facts really haven't changed. It should have been something presented at the onset. If there is a waiver of a challenge to standing, I think this is it. We are well past that. And the other issue here is this is a relitigation of the jurisdiction. While this wasn't a central, like, express holding of Dunham 1, it's implicit in Dunham 1 when you rule on the merits that you have jurisdiction. And we have kind of a chicken or the egg argument happening here where the circuit court is saying, I don't have jurisdiction to hear the case that was remanded to me. And our prior case law says the scope of the remanded is limited to what this court tells the trial court to analyze. And so I think that confusion is resolved if we have a waiver to a challenge to standing that isn't expressly brought in the first instance. And lastly, I would say that the injuries do not just relate to the conditional use permit. The conditional use permit was basically to increase the height and square footage of the structure. And the square footage is defined by the variance in this case, which is the length and width of the building. And so the two are related, and I think that footnote in the Dunham 1 kind of makes everyone aware that this does still exist and that the original challenge to her injuries is related to both of them. I think that's the clearest way to say it. The building size is related to the conditional use and the variance. Thank you.
Thank you. The case is now submitted. We'll be in recess until 11 o'clock this morning.